University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska-Wesleyan University, which brings speakers and performers to the campus throughout the semester to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska-Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum features Yoshitomo Takahashi, assistant in the Department of Neuropsychiatry at Yamanashi Medical College, Yamanashi, Japan. His topic deals with suicide among young adults in Japan. Takahashi is a Fulbright scholar currently researching suicide prevention programs at the University of California's Neuropsychiatric Institute in Los Angeles, California. He has done research on the Japanese decision-making process and their attitude toward psychosis, as well as the history, characteristics, and current trends of suicide in Japan.
Good morning. Welcome to Forum. We've been asked this morning to begin with an announcement, an unhappy announcement. Some of you may already be aware that earlier today, in an automobile accident, we lost a member of our student community. William Hellerich died this morning in an automobile accident. And we want to be sure that everyone is aware of that as soon as possible. There will be additional information forthcoming from Student Affairs, I think, on that issue. I'm not pleased to begin this morning in that way, but we wanted to get that word out. We're here today to hear from an international expert in the field of psychiatry. The topic is a troubling and perplexing one for societies the world over, and that topic is suicide. It's a subject that's replete with misunderstanding and confusion, one that's difficult to research. It's a problem that is of interest to people the world over. And with us today, we have Yoshitomo Takahashi, who's assistant professor in the Department of Neuropsychiatry at the National Yamanashi Medical College in Japan. Dr. Takahashi, who prefers while in this country to be known as Fred, is, and there's a story behind that that's worth telling, but I won't take your time telling it here at this time. Dr. Takahashi is a graduate of the Kanazawa University School of Medicine in Japan, was on staff at the Tokyo Medical and Dental University from 1981 until 1983. He also did postdoctoral work at that university in Tokyo. He's a specialist in suicidology, thanatology, and electroencephalography. And if you can say those three words in the same sentence, you're doing okay. He's interested in a wide variety of topics, including foreign languages and movie making, claims to have learned his excellent English from American movies, and was able to prove in conversation that he knows more about American movies than I do, by far. He's widely published in Japanese medical journals. He is in this country on a Fulbright Junior Research Scholarship at the Neuropsychiatric Institute at the University of California at Los Angeles. And I should say at this point that we owe thanks to the Fulbright people who have been kind enough to assist us in substantial and material ways in bringing Dr. Takahashi here to visit Wesleyan, where he's been, as you know, for the last two or three days. He's accompanied in this country by his wife and two children, but unfortunately they were unable to come to Lincoln, which I think is sad because after spending all of his time in this country in California, Dr. Takahashi is now going to be able to see the United States. Would you please join me in welcoming Dr. Yoshitomo Takahashi, whose topic this morning is suicide among young adults in Japan.
Thank you very much for your kind introduction, Dr. Keith. And good morning, ladies and gentlemen. And first of all, I'd like to express my appreciation for the invitation to this beautiful university and the wonderful time I have been given since my arrival here. And 8 months have passed since I came to the United States, and I've noticed several interesting things in this country. One of those things is that the Americans start a speech with a joke, while the Japanese starts a speech with an apology. So for the past week, I've tried very hard to create a good joke for this presentation. but in vain, so I have to start this presentation by saying I'm sorry for not being able to make a good joke. As Dr. Keith kindly introduced me to you, I've come to the United States to study suicidology. Suicidology means the study of suicide. From the beginning of its history, suicidologists have emphasized not only describing suicidal phenomena, but also finding ways to prevent suicide. For this reason, suicidology is a new and practical academic field. I'm often asked, what's your field? And I answer, suicidology. An average response is, oh, you are a suicide specialist. And I reply, well, actually, I'm not a suicide specialist, but a specialist in suicide prevention. People often think that a suicidologist is a researcher who knows how to commit suicide without pain in 12 different ways. Of course, we know more than 100 different ways, but we don't tell you how, and we emphasize how to prevent suicide. Please forgive me for digressing a little more from the beginning. Let me introduce a certain episode. There is a hierarchy or a pecking order or a priority, you may say, even among struggles with illnesses. Maybe first comes infectious disease like tuberculosis or typhoid fever or recently AIDS. And next comes malignant illness such as cancer or leukemia. And then adult disease like diabetes, hypertension, etc. Unfortunately, mental health comes last and suicide prevention in the bottom. I attended the International Conference for Suicide Prevention at San Francisco last May. There were about 750 participants there from all over the world, but only 4 people came from Asian countries. 3 from Japan and 1 from China. Another episode is my visit to the Philippines. In 1981, I visited the National Mental Health Hospital. A Filipino psychiatrist showed me around the hospital and said to me, Haridol, it's the name of the antipsychotic drug. Haridol is the best medicine for the psychiatric patients in this country. I wondered why. And because I thought there were several other kinds of antipsychotic drugs as good as Haridol. I asked the reason, and the Filipino psychiatrist answered, because it's the least expensive antipsychotic drug available in that country. I was also astonished to find that about 12 patients die at that national mental hospital because of malnutrition every year, every month. In Japan, maybe a large sum of money grant is given to medical researchers nowadays, like cancer researches or genetic engineering, but not suicide prevention or mental health, unfortunately. This is a situation of suicide prevention in Asia. I'm sorry to point out, not much attention is paid on suicide prevention in countries where many people die of hunger or simple illnesses. And I was very happy when I was granted an opportunity to come to this country to observe how progressive suicide prevention programs are actually conducted in this country. Almost 30,000 Americans take their own lives each year. This number is greater by 50% than annual number of homicide in the United States, 30,000. It means that each day today, almost 80 Americans will kill themselves and another 80 tomorrow. As many as 25,000 Japanese commit suicide every year. Suicide rate in Japan is about 20 per 100,000. that is about twice as high as that in the United States. Suicide is the second leading cause of death among young people both in Japan and the United States, with accidents being the first. The suicide rate of young men in the United States now ranks among the highest in the world, surpassing Japan and Sweden, countries long identified with the problems of suicide. It shows how serious this problem is in this contemporary society. It goes without saying that the suicide of a young person is a very tragic event. Family and friends of the victim experience a wide range of emotional distress. Why has there been such a striking increase in suicide rate among young people? There are numerous factors combined which attribute to the rise in suicide rate, such as changes in social values, family structures, lack of social support and employment, pressure to academic achievement, drug abuse, alcoholism, and so on. Sociologists suggest a lot of social factors affecting suicide, but I, as a psychiatrist, would like to talk about the subject from a slightly different way today. I'll talk about suicide among young people in Japan mainly. The first question is, generally speaking, are there some characteristics of suicide in Japan? I'd better start talking about this topic. What do you imagine when you try to think about the relationship between Japan and suicide? Maybe the first thing which comes up to your mind is harakiri. It's a notorious form of suicide in Japan. Harakiri means the ritual forms of suicide that was practiced by the feudal warriors to show that they accepted responsibility for their actions. It has its beginnings about 1,000 years ago. The warriors used to respect the abdomen because it was considered to be the site where the spirit existed. So when they assumed responsibility as warriors for some action or course of conduct and had to die, they would cut open their abdomen and show their innocence and bravery. In the Edo era, about 300 years ago, harakiri became the mode of capital punishment for members of the warrior class. To allow the warrior to die by his own hand showed respect for his character and honor. But in present-day Japan, harakiri is not practiced either as a form of suicide or as a punishment, I should point out. The famous Japanese novelist Yukio Mishima's suicide in 1970 by harakiri was an extremely exceptional case and astonished even the Japanese people. The next question, what are characteristics of suicide in Japan generally now? Roughly speaking, there are two types of suicide commonly found in Japan. One is a suicide in forms of taking responsibility, usually committed by a middle-aged man, and the other is a parent-child suicide pact. I'd like to explain two examples. When someone commits a crime, of course, people around him feel both great shame and a desire to be protective. A good example is former Prime Minister Tanaka's chauffeur. When Prime Minister Tanaka was indicted of taking bribes from Lockheed Aircraft Company, his chauffeur committed suicide rather than gave testimony in court, which might have been damaging to his boss. This type of suicide often happens in Japan. Mass media does not cover cases of suicide so openly, but this is not applied to this type of suicide. They often put big articles in top and report in detail that someone committed suicide in order to take responsibility. when there is an investigation for some wrongdoing, the person investigated often commits suicide, leaving a suicide note like, "That God knows I did nothing wrong. But I've caused the company a great trouble by this indictment. Therefore, I take responsibility for it by committing suicide." Dr. DuBose called it a role narcissism, or intense identification of oneself with one's professional self. Role narcissism compels one towards suicide when a serious error is made in role performance by oneself or by another for whom one is responsible. The suicide committed out of guilt for having caused others trouble through failure in role performance combines intrapunitive communication with role commitment. Not only a committed error, but an anticipated error or failure may induce suicidal anxiety. Then the other example of suicide which often attracts attention in Japan is a parent-child suicide pact. Usually, a young mother in late 20s or early 30s commits suicide with her children. Before committing suicide, she kills her children. The children most often victimized by parent-child suicide pact are preschool age, 4 years old or 5 years old. Many cases of this kind of suicide are reported every year in Japan. Japanese pay much sympathy toward a mother who was not able to find other ways but committed suicide with her children. A similar case is interpreted a different way in different cultures. I understand that most American people think that this is a murder-suicide, not a parent-child suicide pact. You may remember Santa Monica case in California in 1985. A young Japanese mother tried to commit suicide with her two young children by entering the ocean. Her children were drowned, but only the mother survived. What surprised the Japanese society was that she was indicted because of child abuse and first-degree murder in California. I'll give this case for example. On a cold afternoon on January 29, 1985, Fumiko Kimura, age 32, wandering on Santa Monica Beach, heading toward the ocean with her infant daughter in her arms. Her four-year-old son ran before her, laughing and stopping occasionally to dip his hand into the sand and let it fall through his fingers. At the water edge, Kimura lifted both children, then walked into the water. Although they were pulled out from the water 15 minutes later, only the mother survived. Kimura, a Japanese immigrant, faced child abuse and murder charges. She tried to kill herself with her children on January 29th, about 10 days after learning that her husband had kept an extramarital affair for 3 years. She'd been disheartened, depressed, and ruminated suicidal ideation ever since. The reason for her despair were highly personal, but the method she chose to resolve it was cultural, very Japanese. Although she'd lived in the United States for 14 years, she remained Japanese in her thinking and lifestyle, isolated from everything in the community. She didn't drive, spoke little English, knew nothing of her husband's finances or business, and had no hobbies or close friends outside the family. In other words, Kimura was virtually without any kind of a support system which might have sustained her in time of emotional distress. In Japan, the mother-child bond and the mother's dedication for the child are emphasized. Then why is this infanticide by the mother so common in Japan? paradoxically, it is this very strong bond between mother and child that causes the parent-child suicide pact. According to the Japanese logic, the suicidal parent cannot bear to leave the child alive alone. She would rather kill the child because she believed that nobody in the world will take care of her child, that the child would be better off if they die together. This feeling of oneness between parent and child has intensified as a result of the breakdown of the community, where children belong to a wider circle and had fictive parents along with their real parents. Today, because of the development of nuclear family, children, particularly preschool children, belong to their parents alone. I explained the two types of suicide found commonly in Japan. These types of suicide in terms of taking responsibility committed by a middle-aged man, and the parent-child suicide pact, are showing some characteristics of suicide in contemporary Japanese society. Of course, I do not mean that these forms of suicide are only found in Japan. Similar instances are reported in other countries and other societies. You may remember former National Security Advisor Robert McFarlane's attempted suicide last year. But the number is greater and more attention is paid in Japan. No one denies that the suicide of a young person is a very tragic event. But our third question, are there any characteristics of suicide in Japanese young people? It's a very difficult question. The year of 1986 will be remembered of youth suicide in Japan because of several suicide clusters of young people. I'll explain first several examples of youth suicide clusters which happened in Japan. In early 1986, there were clusters of suicide among junior and senior high school students triggered by bullying, which were reported almost every day. Around 9 o'clock p.m. on February 2, 1986, Hiroshi Kagawa, age 14, committed suicide by hanging himself, left a suicide note describing various bullying. He'd suffered bullying by his classmates for as long as 1 year and had been depressed and desperate about the situation. He was ordered to do many trivial jobs for his classmates, give them money, and suffered various physical assaults. His classmates had even a mock funeral for Kagawa 2 months before his suicide. His teacher noticed bullying but did not take any measures to intervene it. His suicide was reported by the mass media intensely. There were articles in newspapers and magazines and programs in televisions featuring Kagawa's suicide every day. After Kagawa's suicide, there were clusters of suicide among junior and senior high school students who also had similar problems of bullying all over Japan almost every day in early 1986. Then came a young singer's suicide and cluster of suicide after her death. On April 8, 1986, teen singing idol Yukiko Okada, age 18, killed herself by jumping from the top of her recording studio building. She'd been depressed over an unhappy love affair with an actor old enough to be her father. Okada had been a successful young singer. In 1983, she won a national talent contest, and she also received an award as Japan's top singer in 1985. She was extremely popular and had a great following. This young singer became even more popular soon after her death. The place that Okada's body hit a busy downtown Tokyo district corner became an impromptu shrine where many laid wreath. Many of Okada's fans were standing at the corner, gazing upward at the building from which she jumped. The media reported widely on the Okada's suicide, interviewing her family, her friends, and even her boyfriend who jilted her. The tragic suicide cluster began 2 days after Okada's suicide. Two sisters, aged 18 and 12, jumped from the roof of their apartment building. In the following days, young people, at least one a day, killed themselves in apparent imitation of the Okada's suicide. Mass media began spending an enormous amount of time analyzing Okada's and followers' suicide. The rate of suicide among the young people dramatically increased. 33 young people took their lives in the 17 days following Okada's suicide, including one girl who was just 9 years old. One of the suicides in this cluster is a 21-year-old Masahiro Majima, who jumped from the same roof as Okada. Majima had photographs of Okada in his pocket and had been seen strolling in front of the building for several days before his jump. 22 of the 33 deaths were like Okada's, suicide by jumping from buildings. When I was asked to talk about suicide among young people in Japan today, I wondered if there are something characteristics of suicide among young people in Japan. I've asked myself that question repeatedly, and I also discussed this topic with my colleagues at UCLA. There have been many explanations, of course, for high suicide rate among young Japanese, such as undue importance attached to educational achievement, a Japanese culture which forces young people to internalize aggression, a group-oriented culture, authoritarianism, recent changes in family structures and social values, etc. But my conclusion was that there are more similarities than differences among youth suicide in different cultures. There were a cluster of suicide among junior and senior high school students who suffered bullying, and a cluster of suicide after a young pop idol's suicide in 1986, as I mentioned. But these kind of the cases are found not only in Japan, but also in the United States. You may remember vividly that there was a suicide cluster of young people in Omaha, Nebraska, in February 1986. Over a five-day period, three students from Bryan High School in Omaha killed themselves, and four other teens made serious attempts on their lives during the same time period. Many researchers have pointed out the role of suggestion or infectiousness in suicide, especially among young people. A suicidal ideation and sympathy toward other suicide exist subconsciously among people who are at high risk of suicide. Such reports of suicide may trigger others. In other words, one suicide may be a model for other people in the society who have been at high risk of doing the same thing. But I think it more important for us to focus on general characteristics of suicide among youth rather than cultural differences. In the last half of my presentation, I'd like to talk about how to detect suicidal person in general, and I'll touch upon some characteristics of suicidal young people particularly. If I may, I'd like to write something on the blackboard. What do you think it is?
Uh,
My mother is a great cook, but I'm not going to explain my mother's special recipe for the salad. And I'm afraid it's not my original, but it's an easy way to remember the risk factors. And each suicide is an individual act influenced by diverse sets of personal and social factors combined. I'm going to explain to you how to evaluate a suicidal person. Of course, it is a very a simplistic way, but are you familiar with the term risk factors? And for example, that overweight and smoking and stress and lack of exercise, diabetes, hypertension, family history of heart disease, etc., for the risk factors of heart disease. And the more risk factors one individual has, the higher the risk is. And I'll explain very briefly how to detect risk factors for potentially suicidal people briefly. First is mental status. The presence of any psychiatric disorder should be considered one of the indications of high-risk groups of suicide. Schizophrenia, some form of personality disorder, depression, hypochondriasis, etc., especially depression. People who are suffering from depression develop various symptoms. They feel sad, down in the dumps, hopeless, helpless, and worthless. They become inactive, lose interest in their work, daily activity, and even hobbies. They develop agitation and anxiety. They lose appetite, weight, and they cannot sleep. That is major depression. A certain survey says that the suicide rate of people with severe depressive symptoms is 200 times as high as that of the general population. If you notice someone near you who may suffer from depression, take him or her to see a mental health professional. I want to point out depression can be treated. The National Institute of Mental Health research evidence indicates that about 80 to 90% of the patients with serious depressive disorders can be effectively treated by a variety of treatments. However, only less than one-third of such patients seek help. We have to reduce their needless suffering, which might lead to suicide. Next is age. Suicide curve shows bimodal. I mean the two peaks. Suicide risk is high among young people and old people. Suicide and age are positively correlated after middle-aged. In other words, suicide rates are high among adolescents and young adults and are known to increase steadily with age, especially after middle-age. People over age 60 made up only 16% of the U.S. population in 1980, but accounted for 25% of those who committed suicide. Next is sex. With respect to sex, the overwhelming majority of completed suicide are males. The male-female ratio among the completed suicide about 3-to-1. Next is support. People who have a weaker support system are prone to commit suicide. Marriage seems to reduce the risk of suicide significantly. Unmarried, separated, divorced, or widowed people show a much higher suicide rate, 4 to 5 times as high as that of the general population. We have to find out who are the significant others, both at hand and distance. Can they assist the patient, so on and so forth. Attempts. Maybe this is the most important. A history of prior suicide attempts should always be explored with lethality and intention. If someone once attempted suicide in the past and failed to die, he or she should be considered one of the very high-risk group. 1 out of 10 who attempted suicide in the past will actually end up killing himself in the future. We must not make light of suicide attempts or suicidal threats or ideation. People often say that person often talks about suicide. Such person does never commit suicide. This is a total myth and total misconception. Once again, we must not make light of suicide attempts or suicidal threats. Every suicide comments, threat, or act should be taken seriously. It's better to err on the side of being overcautious rather than of not being cautious enough. Loss. Recent experience of loss can be trigger to suicide. Loss of a partner, loss of status, social position, reputation, and loss of physical fitness and loss of financial conditions. And finally, alcoholism and drug abuse. Alcoholism and drug abuse weaken the ego's ability to function, resulting in self-destructive behavior, both overt and disguised. For example, an intentional accident. If someone who suffers from both any psychiatric illness and substance abuse, like schizophrenia and alcoholism, the suicide risk becomes again high. So maybe I should add accident proneness and violent behavior, history of suicide in the family, and homosexuality, and accident proneness and violence especially, which occurs recently, should be considered disguised suicidal intentions. Suicidal risk is evaluated by considering these risk factors. The more risk factors one feels, the higher the risk is. More important fact about suicide I'd like to emphasize here is that suicide does not take place suddenly. Suicide almost always occurs in a context. Suicide seldom happens as a totally unpredictable and premeditated act. Rather, there is a long road to suicide in which people consider it, then turn away to try other alternatives, returning to the suicide plan more and more when other solutions fail. So we should look for signs of suicide in an individual's past history. Once again, suicide does not just happen. A feeling of hopelessness, helplessness, and worthlessness developed over a long period of time. The groundwork for suicide is usually laid early. For the most part, this groundwork occurs in the relationship within the family and the kind of validating self-growth experiences afforded the child. To summarize what I explained to you, we should not only evaluate the risk factors of suicide I mentioned, but also consider them in a context of individuals' past history. Now, I'd like to explain one case of youth attempted suicide. Miss A, age 20, was the youngest of 3 daughters of a farmer in the countryside of Japan. Since her childhood, she had always felt that she was the last and unwanted girl in the family. She felt that she had no one to talk to in the family and few friends in school. At age 11, she was raped by the several high school students, but she thought it was what she should not consult with her family. And she concealed this child molestation for a long time. Miss A felt as if she became obscene. She became depressed and withdrawn. She spent much of her time alone and had poor interpersonal relationship with peers and adults. She felt that she had no place to live and that others would be better off without her. She always thought her life was not worth living at all. She felt lonely and isolated and was aware of feelings of sexual inadequacy. She was absorbed in reading novels written by Osamu Dazai, a famous Japanese novelist, who committed suicide. Miss A felt as if the author had described her desperate and hopeless situation and suicidal wish. She'd made more than 10 suicide attempts in the past, since the age of 16, but her family were against referring her to a psychiatrist or psychologist. At age 18, she left home and drifted through a number of jobs. She had an affair with a middle-aged man who had once been her employer for 2 years. She returned home after their relationship had ended, but she felt uncomfortable at home and she wished to live by herself. Her family strongly objected to her idea. After an argument with her family, she decided to kill herself. There is a dense forest at the foot of Mount Fuji, which is known as a leading suicide site in Japan. People believe that once entered the forest, it's almost impossible to get out of the forest, and about 30 people commit suicide every year in that forest. She went there, entered the deep forest, and took a large dose of sleeping pills. It was winter. The forest was covered with snow. She gradually fell asleep, but fortunately, a policeman patrolling the forest happened to find her. Because the forest is known as the suicide site, the police regularly search attempted suicide there. Not very often. She was referred to us. On admission, she was anxious, depressed, and amnesic about herself. Very interestingly, she was not able to tell who she was, how old she was, what her occupation was, who her family were. So she developed amnesia. She had a vague feeling that she had wanted to die, but she did not remember anything else, including her past history. Low self-esteem, unstable personal relationship, suicidal ideation, depressed mood, anxiety, and a chronic feeling of emptiness were observed through regular psychotherapeutic interviews. She recovered from amnesia 7 months after the onset. The newspaper might have reported that Miss A attempted suicide because of a broken relationship with a middle-aged lover. Is it that simple? You can see accumulation of conflicts in her past history leading to the suicide attempt. Chronic feeling of emptiness, low self-esteem, isolation, not only in family, but also in school, sexual molestation at early adolescence, long-term depression, multiple suicide attempts, almost no support system. Her feeling of hopeless, helplessness, and worthlessness can be found in her history. You can see that Ms. A filled most of the risk factors I mentioned before. Broken relationship with a middle-aged lover may be a precipitating factor for her suicide attempt, but before it, there was a long and winding road to her suicide attempt. She'd been a loner and attempted to struggle all by herself with various problems facing her. She finally decided to kill herself and went to the famous suicide site. And she took an overdose of sleeping pills in the deep forest in the winter. If the policeman had not happened to patrol that at that time, she'd have ended up killing herself. She developed amnesia after failing to kill herself. It may be considered a last cry for help. Amnesia can be regarded as a psychological defense mechanism against the suicidal impulse. As you see, there are so many cries for help in her life. When we talk about suicidal young people, besides risk factors I already mentioned and accumulations of conflicts, I should mention that there are several specific types. Generally speaking, there are four different types: psychotic, and loner, perfectionist, and delinquent. I already mentioned the first group, a psychotic. Suicide rate becomes very high among people suffering mental illness, especially depression. The next group is a loner. Isolation and lack of communication is very important in identifying this high-risk group. The young people who committed suicide were essentially more isolated and hopeless and were less likely to send out signals for help. We must take into consideration a loner categorization for one kind of young people who frequently commit suicide. It's been often pointed out that teachers pay more attention to the aggressive, disruptive student, and the uninvolved, withdrawn, and lonely student attracts less attention of the teacher. The next group is a perfectionist. There are some young people who are very perfectionistic. They're inclined to see things in black and white terms. Their thinking pattern is all or nothing, success or failure. Their personality is rather obsessive and compulsive. They're hardworking and a high achiever in a sense, in order to compensate their insecurity feeling. The dichotomous thinking patterns make it almost impossible for them to find various alternatives in a difficult situation. So, in their rigid dichotomous thinking, a slight failure might be considered as a blunder they cannot overcome at all. In order to attract your attention, I'd like to talk a little bit in detail about the last type, delinquent. One of the problems in detecting suicidal behavior in very young people is that traditional depressive signs do not appear as distinctly as they do among adults. The younger the individual is, the less likely these classical signs appear. Instead, conduct disorder and inefficiency in school are likely to mask feelings of depression. Young people are more likely to become agitated or irritable or react in a negativistic fashion or become involved in behavior which is troublesome to others. Among suicidal young people, especially in high school age, provocative and defiant behavior toward parents, physical fights with the friends, delinquency, drug abuse, alcoholism, and little interest in school are not uncommon. The drug abuse and reckless driving can be fatal, often more dangerous to their lives than their actual suicide attempts. Their delinquent behavior per se should be considered as Menninger's chronic suicidal syndrome. They seem sociable rather than withdrawn. They need to be around other people and are often uncomfortable if they have to spend time alone. However, their social contacts are shallow. They become quite uneasy at the possibility of intimacy. Their rebellious behavior, which with their parents, tends to mask that they fear separating from their families despite their unhappiness with them. I'd like to point out once more that suicidal tendency does not occur suddenly. When we discuss the someone's suicidal risk, we look for his or her whole past history, lifestyle, personality trait, and current experiences. People do not kill themselves only because of failing the entrance examination or breaking up the relationship with their friends. Finally, about several comments on therapy briefly. There are a few special techniques for treating suicidal young people. The basic strategy for treating the suicidal young people, I think, is essentially the same as that is for working with the disturbed young people in general. As Dr. Favreau at Los Angeles Suicide Prevention Center has pointed out, mental health professionals must involve themselves with the difficult task of restoring intrafamilial relationship, recovering interpersonal communication, relieving feeling of hopelessness, helplessness, and worthlessness, and providing long-term role model guidance, all the while being constantly tested and challenged by an acting out adolescent. It's often indicated the need to involve the family in the treatment program and provide the basic understanding and concerned interest required to build self-esteem enough to offset recurring suicidal impulse. It's very important to involve the family to the therapy along with the individual therapy for suicidal young people. In a word, we should try every effort to build up the bond between the suicidal young people and the society, the bond which suicidal youth believes lost a long time ago. It is an arduous and hard job. Thank you very much.
Today on University Forum, we've heard Yoshitomo Takahashi, assistant in the Department of Neuropsychiatry at Yamanashi Medical College, Yamanashi, Japan. He spoke on suicide among young adults in Japan. This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is a private undergraduate liberal arts college located in Lincoln, Nebraska. Approximately 1,300 students are enrolled in more than 40 major programs.